Hey everyone, welcome to Share Your Sparkle, and I'm your host, Dr. Darlene Berrios. This is Season 2, Episode 2, Erin Myers. Everybody, thanks for tuning in. We have a great guest today, so let me get right to introducing him. This is Erin Myers. This bio is from his website, aaron2.me. He is an entertainer, artist, veteran, entrepreneur, believer. These are just a few of the titles claimed by DC-based jazz artist Erin Myers, whose life story is anything but typical. Originally from Goodloe, Texas, Myers found his passion for performing at an early age while playing music in the church, eventually choosing the piano as his instrument of choice. His soulful baritone voice, second to none stage presence, and captivating personality make him one of the most exciting up-and-coming acts in jazz. As a young man, Erin joined the United States Army, where he served for 2 years before enrolling at Navarro College, where he majored in business and theater. While at Navarro, Erin ran for mayor of Corsicana, the town where the school was located. Despite losing a closely contested election, Myers decided then and there that politics and advocacy would continue to play a major role in his life. After college, Erin packed up and headed out west to Los Angeles, where he got his first taste of life as a professional entertainer. While in California, he was the featured talent at the Fashion TV's 10-year anniversary party, made his rounds as a studio musician, and served as a music supervisor for the film A Song and a Prayer. Within ministry, he was the assistant to the youth pastor at West Angeles Church of God in Christ, while also serving as the musician for the youth department, never straying too far from his gospel roots. After a life-altering accident that almost claimed his right hand, Erin decided he needed a change. So he joined the Obama Campaign for Change in 2008 as a field organizer in the battleground states of Texas and Florida, finding his love for community organizing and engagement, and slowly working his way back into playing shape. After the campaign was over, he moved to Washington, D.C., where he fostered his gift for advocacy and began establishing himself as a musician to know in the vibrant jazz scene of Chocolate City. Upon Erin's arrival in our nation's capital, he immediately began activating space for live performances around the city, ultimately serving as resident artist at the Black Fox Lounge for 5 years while producing over 150 shows before becoming the current resident artist at the storied Mr. Henry's Restaurant in Capitol Hill. He remained committed to his role as an activist as well, becoming the national director for the now-defunct Global Family Program, headed by the late Linda Grover, staying active with the D.C. Young Democrats, and forming the D.C. Jazz Lobby in 2016, which focuses on music and arts policy initiatives at the federal and local levels. Mr. Myers is a stout advocate for mental health and LGBTQI rights. As part of his advocacy, he chairs the board of directors for the Capitol Hill Jazz Foundation, as well as serves as board secretary of Crittenden Services of Greater Washington. He sits as a member of the board of directors for CTE Vision Foundation and Covenant Full Potential Development Center. During the ongoing COVID pandemic, he has led the DMV Music Stakeholders cohort as they share resources, offer relief, and advocate for community needs to help strengthen and preserve Washington's music ecosystem. Myers has been lucky enough to have had his share of performance, festival, and hosting opportunities throughout his career as a musician. He's played numerous events in his hometown of D.C., including the 50th anniversary of the Peace Corps, the National Legal Aid and Defender Association 100th anniversary, rehearsing, directing, performing with the 100 Voice Choir at the World AIDS Conference, performing at the Library of Congress, and having the pleasure of being a repeat featured artist for the DC Jazz Festival. In 2019, Myers was invited to participate in the Folk Alliance Festival in Montreal, Canada, speaking on a panel that discussed the intersection of arts and activism, before embarking upon a 6-week, 24 Jazz Revolution tour that saw him playing in 20 different cities throughout Russia, a once-in-a-lifetime experience that reinforced his belief in his craft and his ability to make his dream come true. His credits include 3 albums, Leo Rising, The Lion's Den, both included on the Grammy voting ballot, and the holiday album, Snowing in Vegas. He is a voting member with the Recording Academy and also the host of Jazz Stories on WPFW 89.3 FM. You can listen to his music on Pandora, Spotify, Apple Music, Google Play, Amazon, and other digital streaming services. It takes courage to begin, but the art is finishing. Without further ado, people, Aaron Myers. Okay, Aaron, your bio is impressive. Thank you so much for being here today. I mean, from your varied experience in different careers like the military, I mean, your advocacy work, your music, your books. I'm so glad you're here on Share Your Sparkle. So thank you for joining us today.
Thank you for letting me share my sparkle with you today. I appreciate that.
Great. So let's actually get started. Let's talk about music, a true passion of yours, because coming up later this month on April 30th, also International Jazz Day, you're releasing the Pride album, which is an audio and visual event. So first, congratulations.
Thank you very much.
Congratulations. Can you describe where the inspiration or like name for the album came from? Give us a little bit of background about that.
Well, this album, I would say, pretty much saved my life because at the beginning of this pandemic, mentally, I was completely out there. I live with anxiety. And depression. Not bipolar. And a lot of people think for some reason when a person says they live with anxiety and depression, immediately they think bipolar. That bipolar is very distinct and a very specific situation.
Right.
But this health anxiety specifically. So imagine living with health anxiety, right? And then you enter a pandemic and you also have antibodies from you were actually sick with this and your family members and friends are dying from it as well.
Right.
I was frightened to leave my room, and I was seeing my therapist and a counselor.
Mm-hmm.
And my psychologist was, you know, asked a very distinct question as far as what is it that is causing, you know, what are you frightened of? There's something distinctly, and death. I've always had death things. I mean, completely frightened, you know, the end. It comes primarily from being raised by older people. And so when you're raised by people in their 70s and their 80s, a cold could lead to death.
Right.
And so, and my grandparents lived both to be 99. So with that, I didn't sleep with my phone off until 2016. Because I was always concerned already to receive that phone call in the middle of the night. And so my therapist said, it seems to me that one should focus on living and what you're doing while you're alive. And if you're consumed with doing that particular work, that anxiety, you won't have time to focus because anxiety is when you think the end is near, you're thinking the worst, impending doom, that type of thing.
Right.
And so I began to write out quite a bit of my feelings and about the different things and the different ills. And I began to really take a look at this project. And as an independent artist, I put out albums before, but I put out great albums that not a lot of people heard, at least domestically, internationally. Mm-hmm. They'd heard the music and respected and appreciated and celebrated the music.
Yeah.
And so I wanted to ensure that if I was working on a project, I wanted people to hear it. I wanted people who may deal with some of the same issues that I've dealt with to understand me, and it hopefully would resonate with them.
Yeah.
And I thought of the pride like a lion's pride. And the lion's pride is a group and a cohort of animals or people or species in this instance that sleep together, hunt together, work together, live together, love together, the entire thing as a unit, but together they rule. And I'm inviting people to join my global family, and I'm hoping that they'll invite me to join their global family. We could be a part of each other's pride. And that's where the Pride album came from. And from front to end, we begin, and literally we begin with Make Them Hear You from Ragtime. That's the first song that opens the album as a call to action, you know, going to Down by the Riverside, a spiritual that is requesting the ancestors, you know, permission to speak. And then the first topic we address, the song that I wrote called New Jim Crow, which is third, and we go all the way through. So this has been, it was been a labor of love. I raised $22,500 in 2 months to finance this project.
Nice.
To do it the right way.
Mm-hmm.
And still working considerably hard. I was up to about 4 o'clock last night, ensuring that all the back end work is done and we've done the proper marketing outreach and stuff together. Jazz represents 1.1% of consumed music in the United States, which is very small. But within that small amount, that demographic of people ranges from 16 to 90. And so you are really trying to target and this, that, and the other, do what we can to make it happen. But that's the Pride album.
And I was, as you were speaking, like those song names that you mentioned, like gave me the chills, you know, and when you spoke, it really resonated. And thank you for being honest about like mental health, because I really think that if anything, this is a time of healing, whatever the healing that needs to happen for individuals, as a group, as a collective, you know, in humanity. So I think it seems like this album is like, this is the perfect time for it, right?
I'm hoping that it not only does it resonate, that people will be first able to acknowledge the hurt.
Mm, right.
Maya Angelou once stated that when her son went to college, I believe in Africa, and she went with him, and he was involved in a terrible accident. And she was distraught, worried, and this African woman stated to her, she said, you need someone to watch you cry, not to console you as you cry, not to try to stop you, to stop the tears, to just simply watch you cry, to be vulnerable enough to cry openly and allow someone to watch you cry. And I think this entire time we have been trying to move past, skirt around, keep from having to feel these deep emotions, this deep pain. We saw with the death of George Floyd that people took to the streets, but it oftentimes going to the streets was to not avoid dealing with the pain, but it was only a part. It was some part, not some total in dealing with the pain.
Yeah.
And so I'm hoping this album will allow us to first resonate with and say, there's one song on this called Don't Ask Me to Smile. And it basically, it tells how many people of color, many people who've been othered have been asked to smile so that other folks can feel happy, comfortable, safe, okay, nurtured,
right,
absolved, right? And so we smile to mask those things. And even sometimes we protest to mask those things. The entire thing. And I was on the front line of the protest here in Washington, at least during the pandemic. And so I don't want people to take away that, well, he's saying protest as no, protesting is only some part.
Right.
The sum total is saying, I am hurting.
Mm-hmm.
I want to heal.
Yeah.
I am not healed yet. I am still broken. I am still in pain. And I won't be healed in a calendar amount of days. In 40 days, this will not be okay.
Right.
And so I've been talking to a lot of my LGBT cohorts. I was talking to a friend of mine, was it Wednesday? I went to pick up, since we've talked, I received the Whammy Award, Washington Area Music Award.
Congratulations. Award. Yes.
Advocacy.
Yeah.
Know? And one of the conversations we had is that like LGBTQ people still do not have safe spaces really to record. And then LGBT people, LGBTQ people who are on the production side of entertainment do not have a safe space at times to work.
Wow.
And so we were discussing, like, what do we do, those of us who have platforms, what do we do to extend that our platform and lend it also to them? But then once it's lent, since we now have a platform, we don't have a calendar amount of days to say, well, we stopped feeling the pain of being othered for so long. That still hurts. I don't care if I have a doctor in front of my name. I do not care if I have got a great position. I don't care. that othering still hurts. And just because I've attained certain status, whether it's in my music or what have you, it doesn't mean that that pain has gone away. And to those people who have been othered because of their sexuality and also othered because of their skin color.
Oh, right.
That's a double whammy. We do not get to, you don't get to tell me, just smile.
And right.
Fine. Or you protested last week, so you should be good. You got that all out of your system.
Yes. No.
We have put our pain in every song.
Yeah.
In every poem, in every design, in every, our pain is in architecture. The gamut, our pain is there, hoping that our pain would be removed from the peripheral to the purview.
Mm.
And it's not been done yet, but hopefully this album will do it.
Amen. Amen. There we go. Let's talk about your ancestors, because you mentioned that a little bit. And when we talked prior to this, I really loved what you were saying about their role, like,
yes,
currently and throughout your life, but specifically, like, not just in your life, but related to this album. And it seems like everything that you touch, your ancestors are there with you. So can you speak more to that? Because in the past year or so, I've been feeling my ancestors more than I have in my whole life. And it's a very different experience for me right now, feeling that. So can you talk more about that?
Oh, yes. So I'm a comedy of errors. Now, I'm the oldest of 13 children, but my mother and father only had me. So I have what people say half brothers have. I don't believe in the term half anything. But I am the only product of that union. So I like to say, a comedy of errors. Once one realizes how many people it took to create you, I was reading an article the other day which said that your grandparents, your grandmother actually, carried you and your mother at the same time. Because when a woman is born, she's born with all the eggs she'll ever have, which means when your mother was conceived, she already had the eggs that contained you. Which is an amazing thing to think about. So I think of it, if you think of your ancestors in terms of grands, so, you know, your grandmother and then your great-great-grandmother and then your great-great-great-great-grandmother, the comedy of errors it took for you alone to get here, they do not leave you.
Right.
I mean, I'm in a crowded space now with them all around me. I have felt them uplifting me. Cicely Tyson said, we don't stand on their shoulders, we stand on their backs. Which is different.
Very different, yeah.
And I know for this album, when I think of the pride, I think of my ancestors being a part of my pride. When I think of, in the African tradition, when one is addressing the a group or the community, the organization, or you're in a congregational setting, you ask the ancestors for permission to speak. And I feel like during this particular time, I have found myself constantly asking and referring back to my ancestors for permission to speak, permission to speak, permission to speak, permission to speak. And that permission at times is granted, at times it's not granted. And one has to be sensitive to hear and understand that this is not a, to the Christian listeners, you know, do not think of ancestor worship, I guess you could say, in a sense that takes away from one's faith, as long as you're talking about the Father. You're drinking one's blood and eating bones and flesh and speaking of the Holy Spirit and this, that, and there. Please do not begrudge your own ancestors that are right there readily available to you.
Right.
That does not take away any power away from whatever faith tradition you are a part of.
Right.
And so I have found myself really relying on my ancestors. And there are times I'm sitting on the porch and I feel that presence. It's undeniable.
Right.
When you are sensitive enough to allow yourself to feel the presence of your ancestors, it stays you in moments. I remember when I was getting ready to go on stage for my first time in Russia.
Mm-hmm.
And during that entire tour, I had my own dressing room. The band had their dressing room, had my own dressing room. And I was looking in the mirror, and I was, you know, getting ready, and I was doing the International House of Music in Moscow.
Mm-hmm.
And getting ready to walk out of my dressing room, I just looked in the mirror. And for a split moment, it's almost as if there was a crowd around me.
Wow.
And I'm like, okay, we got this. Mm. And I encourage people who are listening, when you're getting ready to encounter certain either challenges or projects or tasks, just say, we got this. Because your ancestors have not only lived and endured, but they've already paid the ultimate price. They've already completed their cycle, and they're continuing their cycle in this form, supporting you. DNA wise, they are literally with you.
Right.
Your ancestors are literally with you, especially for those people who are people of color.
Mm-hmm.
Even their fear and pain has been passed down.
Right.
So they are a living part of you. So the ancestor worship is not just something theoretical or something you're worshiping like this. It's simply acknowledging and being sensitive enough to allowing that energy to be felt.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I just what I call T-storm, where your eyes well up when you said, we've got this, you know, like that. You usually think, well, maybe this is my own personal experience going into something like, oh, I've got this. But I, going forward, will now say, we've got this, because I'm not alone. Because in like our bone marrow is the people that lived before us, you know, are the people that lived before us. So that's, I love, we've got this. That's
we've got this.
Yeah, you made me cry. You made me T-storm.
Well, I think of my grandmother would tell me a story that her grandmother would tell her about her mother. So it would have been my grandmother's great grandmother.
Okay.
And she said that they were this is when they were on the plantation. So this would have had to have been in South Carolina. Now, my family's been in Texas since the 1850s or early 1860s. So this would have had to be when she was a little girl in South Carolina on the plantation, which would have meant that her mother may have been a first, may have come on the slave ship over. We're not positive when exactly we got here. Nonetheless, though, says that her mother was a cook in the big house.
Mm-hmm.
And being a cook in the big house, the slave master was not kind. And the slaves did not have a lot to eat. So when she made dinner, she made a small cake to take home.
Okay.
They take back to the cabin.
Mm-hmm.
And she was discovered. It was discovered that she had done this. And the master told her that he was going to whoop her first thing in the morning. There was a soothsayer who was on the plantation, one of the women who had brought the traditions from the motherland with her.
Uh-huh.
And so she went to her and she expressed what had happened. And the woman told her, said, I want you in the morning before the sun comes up to go to the big house. I want you to blow in the keyhole 3 times. And then I want you to walk back home, but don't look back.
Mm.
And so she did this. And that next morning, she was not whooped or whooped ever again. Now, this is, we don't know, that the slave owner could have just forgotten and been like, whatever, you know,
right.
Just, you know, could have had a nice change of heart or whatever, what have you. But this story resonated with my great, great grandmother so much, so deeply, that she shared it with her grandmother, with her granddaughter.
Right.
Who then shared it with her grandson, something that happened well over probably 150 years ago, was so strong and resonated so deeply within her DNA that it resonates still with me today.
Right.
That coincidence, comedy of errors, what have you, resonates with me today because her spirit's with me. She's right here with me. And I remember when my grandparents would tell me stories, my grandfather would tell me stories about when they were in the, plowing in the field, because my grandfather was, my grandparents were sharecroppers.
Okay.
And he told this story of this oak tree that was in the middle or near this cotton field. And there were so many, that tree was the point of life for those workers. You know, it's where under its shade you had your lunch, your dinner, this, that, and the other. My uncle had a heart attack. He walked to it and collapsed. And I remember my grandfather would take me on these drives, and he took me to the oak tree. And it was as if I could see in the field all these people working, and I could see these stories come to life. And it shows you just how much, how much we're renting space or leasing space here. If the trees could talk, which they do in their rings, you know, they would tell so many stories of people who walked these very grounds before us.
Right.
And I think it's a, it's an amazing thing to take in. And if you do take it in, you, it helped, it's helped me through my anxiety.
Yeah.
It's helped me through my depression. I can say that.
Yeah. That's amazing. And to think about like nature and trees rooted in one spot forever and what they witnessed throughout their lifetime, you know, that could be like over a hundred years.
Well over a hundred years.
That would be an interesting book if someone wrote from the tree's perspective. You know what I'm
saying? I've always wanted to ask a tree, who planted you?
Hey, it might be a bird.
It could be a bird. I mean, I've always wondered, like, you know, who put you here? You know, well, because you've seen things. I think if you really think of things from a tree's perspective, a tree's story does not start from the perspective of towering over anything.
Right. Goes down
first. It speaks and it starts from breaking through earth. Mm-hmm. It starts from breaking out of a shell, out of a seed, out of something, to break out of something and still be below ground.
Right.
And then to come up and everything is towering over you.
Yeah.
And every storm could be your end.
Right.
You know, every small animal could be your end, you know, until all of a sudden you are this mighty being that's towering over, but still, you know, the larger things are, the more sought after as prized possessions once they fall.
Right. That makes a good point. Yeah.
You know, so it's the different challenges one attracts, the larger one gets, you know, because it's not often that a shrub is concerned about lightning.
Right.
But a tree may,
of course,
may be concerned with that, you know. So,
yeah.
Yeah.
There's a quote, I can't remember who said it, but from a seed, a mighty trunk will grow, you know, just like so much, just from something. And when you look at the acorns, that's it, like this big, you know, like the size of my thumb. Bam!
Huge.
Right? A big oak tree or some elm tree. Yeah. It's.
My grandmother was huge in gardening, and many older women, especially women of color, were really into gardening because those are things that, if you just simply took care of them, the beauty was free. The earth provided that for you.
Yes.
You know, the universe would give that to you. You know, and if you were just a good caretaker of it, that simple beauty could bring you joy, and it cost you nothing.
Right.
Really to have. But I remember my grandmother, when they moved into their last home, the next to last home on the property they had bought, she had planted these trees, you know, around. So the time I came around, came about, these trees were adults. But by the time my grandmother died, these trees are huge.
Yeah.
And I just thought about it, like, you know, as you were leaving out of the house, and you look back and around the foliage and the shade that's being provided, you're like, oh my goodness, she did that.
She did that, yeah. She started it.
She started that, and
yeah,
and she was a good caretaker. She cared for it enough, or to the point to where it could care for itself,
right?
And really be one with the universe, you know. I mean, and Texas is not the it's a Texas heat, East Texas, East Texas, the ground. is what they call black dirt. Mm. I'm not sure if people know what black dirt becomes. Tell so me. Dry that mm-hmm. it cracks open. Okay. You at times during the summer, especially when there's been a lack of rain, you can walk out and look down in the earth. And so it's also very fertile ground once it is tended to and properly watered and moist, mm. you know, that kind of thing. And so I think of if a tree can survive that.
Yeah, right.
Lack of rain or moisture and cracks in the earth, you know, and that dryness and mm-hmm. can survive, you deserve to be there. And I think that's what we have to kind of just take notion that we deserve to be here.
Right.
With the moments and the droughts, without the droughts of encouragement, the droughts without nurture, the droughts without being affirmed, mm-hmm. the droughts without being included, we deserve to be here. And especially if we've survived all of those things, we deserve to be here. And we are here. We got this.
Exactly. And especially the resilience piece, right? That when you have these challenges that happen, that you just makes you a different tree or a different person in life.
Yes.
You know, speaking of, well, I mean, not yet, but activism, but like, you know, trying to stand up for things, you see music or the arts as activism. Yes. Can you say a little bit more and speak a little bit more about that? Because that's such a, I think, a powerful theme, using your strength, whether it's your writing, your music, your art, to change the world in a positive way. So can you talk to us about that a little bit more?
Well, you know, in Make Them Hear You, the first song from the album, and that's from Ragtime. And, you know, there's a line in there that says that your sword could be a sermon or the power of the pen.
Mm.
Right. And so I've always believed that one should advocate for their audiences, both on stage by giving stellar music and then by off stage, using that platform to speak truth to power through your art.
Mm-hmm.
And so and I'm grateful. I mean, this week alone, last week, that is, the Jazz Journalist Association awarded me, acknowledged me at least as being a jazz hero for Washington for advocacy.
I saw that. You're on a roll. I mean, do you feel like there things are coming at you and they're like, yes, thank you.
Well, you know, when it comes to anytime you can receive your flowers while you can smell them is a great thing, you know, but it also goes to show that there you don't get this without doing the work. And
right.
I've often told young advocates, because the advocacy that I believe in is an advocacy that I saw. Mm-hmm. I watched on Sundays when they would announce at church the sick and shut in, those mm-hmm. people who were sick and shut in. Then I would watch on Monday and Tuesday as my grandmother walked the community to those homes
mm.
to clean and to offer food and to sit with people who were sick.
Right.
I watched growing up as my cousin and my mother worked with the NAACP to remove the Confederate flag above our courthouse.
Mm-hmm.
I watched growing up as my grandparents planted a garden in the back of their home and said anybody could come and get what they wanted, just don't take too much, basically.
Wow. Yeah, yeah.
Without paying, you know, mm-hmm. for free. I watched my grandparents can preserves and then give them away, you know. I think of those. So the advocacy that I know, younger advocates be like, well, how do you get paid for this? I said, well, first of all, I schedule for myself the amount of time I want to donate and dedicate to certain things.
Mm-hmm.
The moment you feel resentful toward the cause you're working for is the time that you need to reevaluate your balance.
Good point, yeah.
I do not feel as if any of the advocacy that work that I've done has robbed me of any time away from my career, anything else, because it's time that I willingly and purposely set aside to do that advocacy work. And right. I always say that I advocate in a very selfish way, because I advocate for things that have touched me personally. Mm. And I know that these things could literally help other people if someone who has been through it, in it, seen it, could offer some type of support to it.
Right.
So that people could be aware of it.
Yeah.
And that it could be changed for the better. Oftentimes we offer help and support to communities without asking the community, how do they need help or support?
Right.
You know, and I often tell, I see people who speak of those who are homeless, who ask for assistance on the street in their home, basically.
Mm-hmm.
And people say, well, I'll give them food. Well, if he asks you for food, or she asks you for food, or they ask you for food, give it to them. But if they ask you for cash, give them cash.
Mm.
If it's your, and they often say, well, I don't want them to go and get drugs with it.
Right.
Well, how often has your employer asked you what you were doing with your money?
Good point.
Right?
Right.
How often has that happened? No. You don't give your employer a ledger of how you spend your dollars.
That's and you're, really funny.
You know, and so we should not. So if a person is, you know, asking for money, if you have it to spare,
mm-hmm.
do it. And then if you don't have it to spare, simply say, I don't have it to spare. Mm-hmm. I don't have it to spare. Acknowledge their presence. There's nothing worse than you asking for. We have become so accustomed in this country to walking by and not acknowledging someone who asks for help.
Right.
So we should not then be surprised when we see mass shootings on television. We do not rally ourselves together to help solve that situation.
We have
grown callous to those people who are on the street. We drive past them. They have cardboard. They're sitting there. And sometimes we become resentful if we don't have it to give. And we become angry at them. And we take it out on them, you know, by being rude to them when that is not called for.
Right.
You know, and so I believe advocacy starts. I was talking to the chief diversity officer at Twitter.
Mm-hmm.
And I asked her, I said, what could I say on stage that could perhaps have a CEO in that audience reconsider hiring women in leadership?
Mm-hmm.
What could I say? What could I do?
Yeah.
It's my goal to understand the full breadth of my platform,
mm-hmm.
and then to understand with that platform exactly how I can help, who I can help, when I can help, you know, and most importantly, what I can help.
Right.
It's important for you to know what your, some people use their social media to lend support.
Mm-hmm.
Some people will, they will, whatchamacallit, they will, curate their shows, the songs of their shows, to lend or to spotlight a certain issue.
Mm-hmm.
Other people will actually say something verbally about it on stage. Some people will put things in programs.
Yeah.
Some people will go a step further and start learning about what the solutions look like. I do not believe in alerting people to problems alone.
Mm-hmm.
If there's no solution there, I there's not much I can do. I would love to alert people to either those people who are searching for the solution, trying to find the solution, or to the solution. But to yell, you know, join the chorus of people yelling that there's a problem does not offer a solution.
Right.
And that's part and parcel of what where people may be confused, or where frustration may be with people who want to advocate but don't know how, because all they see is the problem.
Right.
People are surprised when we got the vaccine so quickly, and I don't trust it. I'm like, no. That's what it looks like when your government puts full attention and force behind an issue and a problem that they want to see a solution. Had we seen this type of concerted effort behind the HIV and AIDS pandemic, we would have had PrEP in the 80s.
Yeah, that's a good point.
You know, Right. We could have had PrEP in 1981.
Right. But it was a marginalized group that was being affected mostly. Right. And so
that
gets to be put on the back burner, right? It shows you
how long we were on the back burner. We were on the back burner.
Decades.
And still today.
Yeah.
Still right now. And within that group, people feel as if just because you're LGBT, that you're all together. There is marginalization that happens within that group.
Right.
Too. So women of color who are part of the LGBT community are ostracized. People mm-hmm. of color are ostracized. It's still a white man's world when it comes mm-hmm. to what's right as far as being LGBT in this country. So that is, the HRC was a white boys club, and still they just hired last year their first black executive director for the human rights campaign.
Wow.
That should say something.
Oh, absolutely. Right. There's a lot of healing and work to be done.
That you should be a part, that as your advocacy, you know where what is the solution. I always ask people, what would you like, or how would you like to feel and or be treated?
Mm.
Because if you're in a situation now where you feel like you're being overlooked, mm-hmm. then your solution is there. You need to be heard, accepted, acknowledged, this, that, and the other. What does that look like?
Yeah.
When I'm doing some diversity training at times, people forget that as new hires, you can advocate. If you've gone through the hiring process and you've not talked to one woman or person of color, you mm-hmm. can ask in that moment, well, why haven't I not seen this?
Right, right.
What is your diversity like? These are my diversity expectations.
Yeah.
Before you come on board, before you start negotiating salary, you can ask those questions then.
Absolutely. Yeah.
And then if you get hired somewhere, you can then ask, where is a shortcoming in my company? What does a solution look like? And then when you address your director, you address your board of directors, you address your leadership, you address them with the solutions. These mm-hmm. are my proposed solutions that I have, because they will be just as frustrated with you that there's a problem, or they're being called out on a problem.
Right, right.
Because being called out on a problem only leaves a type of accusation. White people often feel as if they are being blamed for creating racism mm-hmm. when they were born into it just as we were.
Right.
The Queen of England, and we and of course today we give her our respect to Her Majesty and the loss of her husband.
Mm-hmm.
But she had no more choice as being born to the lineage that she was born into, mm-hmm. as the person who is now homeless on the street.
Yeah.
Neither of them had the choice in being born in the position that they were born in.
Right.
As you grow and as you learn and develop, you do have a choice of seeing if the status of which you have been born into can lend its privilege to others, mm-hmm. extend its privilege to others, or will I continue the tenets of racism by mm-hmm. benefiting from these systems that other people,
right,
versus tearing down those systems.
Exactly.
And there's these systems exist within the homeless community as well.
Mm-hmm.
Just because the people are homeless doesn't mean that the biases are not still there.
Right.
And there's still a level of safety that's not extended to people of color and people in the LGBT community, especially our trans homeless youth.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. There's a lot of healing and work to be done. And there's progress, right? But it takes people like you. That's one of the reasons why I started the podcast, was to share people's stories.
Right.
Because I think that everyone's story is really important, and there are some voices that just haven't been heard before, and this is the platform for that. But speaking of stories, June 10th.
Yes.
So not only do you have music that's coming out soon, and some, singles have been released, but one, it's a special day for you, June 10th.
Yes. Very special.
Yeah,
it's been a holiday my entire life.
Your whole life. And you could, if you want to say a little bit more about that, that'd be great. Yeah. But your book, by the way, is being released. So not only do you have your album coming out soon, but then in a couple months, your book, By the Way. Mm-hmm. So you've already written a book. Yep. Titled White People Talking to White People. But give us the inside scoop on your journey of writing By the Way.
By the Way is going to be released on what my grandparents were married for 71 years
before Amen.
My grandfather died. They married June 10th, 1940.
Mm-hmm.
And so the entirety of my life, I've known that to be a day to celebrate. My grandmother died in 2016, and I have to stop Sorry. Myself from trying to call her because mm-hmm. it's just so natural for me to, you know, reach out and to, and what are we doing? What are we all doing? What did you get granny? What did you get yeah. grandpa? Like this whole thing. And I remember looking at pictures from different weddings or different family reunions. That union brought about all of us.
Right.
That comedy of errors, that's amazing. And in this book, I wanted to, I always say the book is called By the Way.
Mm-hmm.
I wanted to let people understand the full humanness. You know, one sexuality is only part and parcel.
Mm-hmm.
It's not the sum total. It's only the sum part of who we are. And there's so many other influences and things that played a huge part in who we are. Mm-hmm. And then, by the way, this is our sexuality.
Mm-hmm.
And that is not to take away from one sexuality. It's not to take away from that part of us, but it is to show the depth in all of the things that makes us who we are. And my family was part of that. And I like to say that this book really became real. I was writing the chapter on my grandmother.
Mm-hmm.
And the chapter on my grandmother speaks that, you know, about smiling, you know, being able to smile. And my grandmother had a smile that was so comforting.
Mm-hmm.
But I had to think of like all the things she smiled through.
Right.
And I remember sometimes she would be in the kitchen, you know, and she would just be humming away. I can still hear her humming while she was cooking, you know, and she hummed all day long if I think of it. And there are two different particular moments that I outline in the book that really made this book real for me. One of which was when her brother died.
Mm.
Uncle Jay was born in 1906. He died. He was in his 90s. We were at the repast, and I happened to be sitting at the table with her sister, her last, you know, surviving sister, Aunt mm-hmm. Emma, and their cousin, Julius, their first cousin. I was sitting there, and I was looking around the room. I looked at the table, and I thought to myself, this may be the last time they all sit together like this.
Mm.
This may be it.
Mm-hmm.
And my grandmother looked at me, and she said, are you okay? I said, oh, I'm fine. And she smiled.
Mm.
And she simply smiled. She said, there's no time to think about that now.
Mm.
Don't think about that now. And she smiled. Maybe she was aware. Maybe she was not aware. She was the last one to survive that table.
Wow.
You know, of her people. Mm-hmm.
Right.
In a sense, you know. And I also think of when my aunt called me, I had... I was in New York writing the book initially,
mm-hmm.
starting, and I'd done the outline and I was working on her chapter. And I was in New York and she called me. She said, Aaron, Granny's developed what they call a Kennedy ulcer. And it's mm-hmm. when your organs are starting to decay and the fluid or the toxins, it comes either on your chest or your bum, different
okay.
parts of your body.
Yeah.
But usually it's a sign that the end is nearing. So
mm-hmm.
I caught a flight. I went directly to Texas, went right to the facility where she was staying at, and I stayed a few days with her in the facility. I just mm-hmm. stayed in her room
wow.
And tried to help her best I could. And I flew back to Washington, and she was in some pain and discomfort. I just wanted her to be at peace. And
mm-hmm.
my aunt called me. She said, you know, mother's gone, you know. But when she went to look at her, and she had a smile.
Wow.
she had a smile. She was laying there with a smile.
Mm-hmm.
And I imagine in that smile, her father died in 1931,
mm-hmm.
a month before her grandmother died. Her mother died in 1977.
Mm.
You know, I think of all the people and friends she must have missed.
Right.
But in that one moment, she had a smile knowing that, hey, I'll get to be reconnected in some way
mm-hmm.
with these people, according to her faith tradition.
Right.
You know, and so I think of that, you know, that's when the book became real. That things of that nature shaped me far more than my sexuality did.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I would say, notwithstanding my sexuality mm-hmm. at all, but that played a part. That's etched. I think of that more so than I think of the last Grindr hookup I had.
Right.
Right.
Yeah. Like, yeah. Right.
That is etched upon yeah. my mind. You know, and so I wanted to write this book, and I wanted people to know that there's different elements of my life that I'm not. It's not germane only to me.
Mm-hmm.
There are other people who were born in small communities who had to develop and learn and had lives. Oftentimes, people who are from smaller communities, villages throughout this country,
mm-hmm.
we are the extra. We are the statistic. We are not considered when laws are created. I had when Malcolm X's daughter came here to do a lecture, and there was a public comment, you know, and people were talking about the civil rights movement. And I simply stated, you know, the civil rights movement did not extend to my community.
Mm.
We did not mm. witness the marching, and we did not witness the sittings and the counters. That didn't happen. My folks mm-hmm. were still picking cotton up until the 60s.
Got it.
They didn't yeah. integrate until 64. You know, 70 in one place. And so this history is not a history of my grandparents. This is a history of my mom.
Mm-hmm. Right.
You know, and then this is a history of me.
Yeah.
You know, when I ran for office and the racism I experienced during that time, or going to the bathroom at high school and seeing the N-word etched in the mirror, not just graffiti on the etched in the mirror,
right.
You know, having to leave a friend's house because his uncle was coming and his uncle didn't like Black people, or seeing the Confederate flag and being told, Aaron, you know, this is heritage or not hatred. And, oh, Aaron, you're one of the good Black people. You're not one of those, you know,
right.
Or you're so well-spoken. Oh, you love that you're so articulate
mm-hmm.
and that type of, this happened in my lifetime. I remember being called the N-word. I was in fourth or fifth grade walking to school. Well, I was going to an extracurricular activity on a Saturday mm-hmm. with two of my white friends, and the path we chose to walk, there was no sidewalk. Mm-hmm. There was grass, a ditch, and then a yard. And as we were walking on that grass, this white man walked out of on his front porch and said, "You get that in out of my yard." You know, I'm simply walking,
right?
You know, but this is in my lifetime.
I know. Oh,
so yeah. This is something when I hear people talking about the civil rights movement and progress or whatever, I know what I know my lived experience.
Right.
My lived experience now is history, but it is recent history.
Mm-hmm,
and it's
mm-hmm.
not a long ago forgotten time. So things like this insurrection we just saw,
mm-hmm.
and you hear about the new name of the Proud Boys,
mm-hmm.
things. This is scratching or tearing off a recent wound that's not yet healed.
Absolutely. Right. I agree.
It's not even removing a scab. It's poking at an open wound because mm-hmm. we're still with it. I have problems paying taxes. I just paid my taxes last week.
Mm-hmm.
And I always feel bad doing so because the services in which our taxes paid for, people of color are still discriminated against.
Right.
And receiving. That's not been rectified. So we pay for poor treatment.
Yeah.
We're paying our tax dollars not to receive the full, the fullness, the full respect that we are promised.
Right.
You know, it's sort of like when our grandparents would go and go to certain stores and buy goods, but then their change would be given, put on the table.
Mm-hmm.
They would, you know, or they would be shortchanged when it was time to weigh the cotton.
Right.
You know, the whole nine, you know, this is just something that we still deal with in this country. And that weighs upon me. And then I tried to do by the way, because when it comes down to my sexuality, there's certain inequities there that A, deserves its own book.
Mm-hmm.
But there's certain things that, because of where I was raised, I was not raised around healthy LGBT people. I didn't know what a healthy relationship would look like to LGBT people. I didn't know what a happy person in the community would look like, an out person in the community. I didn't know. I didn't have any examples of that whatsoever. And I often tell people my first sexual experience, I could have contracted HIV. It was unprotected and it was in a bathhouse, because I just knew that's where you would go. And I didn't know any better. I felt that I would not need protection because a guy couldn't get pregnant. So we should be
right.
But I had, no one had told me this information. Imagine if in these small towns and hamlets and villages and places, if this education alone would happen, how many lives could have been saved?
Right.
You know, things, simple things like that. And I write the book in hopes that young queer people and people who are just coming of age, in a sense, won't have to go through part of what I went through, but will understand what I went through. It's not our responsibility as people who have been in the, who have had the privilege of surviving our time, being authentic to who we are, to force the hardships we went on upon young people as a rite of passage.
Right.
They will deal with their own challenges without our help.
Right.
In that area. So I feel that when I see here a 14-year-old guy or girl who has discovered who they are and they are engaged in a relationship, as it should be, as you're developing.
Right.
This is how, naturally how it should should happen. I don't want to say, well, they're too young to no, they're the right age. What I hear about that 6-year-old who is transitioning, that's when most people, and that I've talked to who have transitioned, that's when they start to feel different. They feel like something's wrong. Well, let's rectify the problem as it's happening,
right,
so that they may grow to the fullest of who they can be.
It's
a very akin to what our grandparents went through, who were left-handed, to write with their right hands, so that they could get by, so their teacher would not punish them, or so they would not feel othered. They were something wrong with them if they were left-handed. So, and if anyone here, every day, twice daily, I write an affirmation with my non-dominant hand.
I love that. I love it.
I do that so I can focus, so I can really, it causes you to concentrate. But I'm fortunate that I only have to do that twice daily. I could not imagine if everything I did to be done with my non-dominant hand. Well, if that's how that feels, imagine how a person of color feels trying to operate in this country, how a person in the LGBT community feels, or how women feel.
Yeah. So many layers, and speaking like so many puzzle pieces that make up who we are, you know, and us being part of the queer community. Let's explore that a little bit. You talked a little bit, but as a bi male, of color, right? Yeah. They're almost like two different conversations. They come together, but they're different.
The redheaded stepchild of the letters. We're not invited to any of the parties. I always tell people, it's like, you know, the other acronyms, the L, you know, get together. Like, I called G, so we're going to go do this. T's already there, you know, like, oh my God, does B have to come? Q is coming. Q's going to be fun. Q's going to be great. But B, does B must be, well, we won't tell B. We'll tell B the party ends at 10.
Oh my goodness.
But
yeah,
we're going to stay until 12, okay? Mm-hmm. So, like, the B part for both, and what I've seen at least, for both men and women, women endure this deal themselves too, from my understanding. Mm-hmm. But from my experience, being bi has not been the most welcomed sign in either side of things. But then being Black, bi, I have to point to something. I always believe in recent, and I've said this often here, recent history, because it makes dating crazy. I was on Hinge, which is a dating app, and a girl matched with me or whatever. And in my profile, I'm open. I say that I'm bi. It's okay. There.
Yeah.
And she said, I did read over your profile. However, this happened yesterday. And the bi comment made me pause. Mm. And I simply said, why pause? She said, I'm a Christian. I notice you are too.
Mm-hmm.
I said, yes, I am. I said, okay, praise the Lord. Amen. She said, no judgment at all. And I appreciate your transparency. If you serve God and know his word, I'm sure you can understand why, as a Christian, that isn't something I personally could welcome or support. I just want to be transparent about that as well. And I simply replied, I serve God and I know God's word, and I do not understand why one wouldn't welcome or support a person, but that's your prerogative. Mm-hmm. One sexuality does not cancel out or exclude someone from having a personal relationship with the Christian God, and God from being in relationship with that person. There's so much scholarship done where the subject of spirituality and sexuality has been dissected, and one could simply do the research and see the antiquated and problematic interpretations of scripture has othered and caused great harm to people and systems, so much so it's permeated into self-hate for many people who are LGBT, but also desire a relationship with God. So no, I will not pretend to understand your logic, nor will I hate you for your logic. But just as you may not agree with me, please know that I cannot welcome or support your logic. Mm. No judgment.
And then you should end with, God made me.
Yeah.
Wow. Yeah. That was good. That was a great response.
So, but this has just happened yesterday.
That was a great response.
Thank you. I want people to know that that experience, and the Black community specifically, by men, have been closely associated with being down low. But coming out in the Black community, whether you're gay or anything, has not been supportive in the African-American community until now. And even now, that's not fully realized.
Mm-hmm.
I'm very fortunate in my family that I have a family that is supported and loved me. I've never questioned their support or their love. It's an anomaly.
Mm-hmm. It's wonderful. Lucky you, because people have such varied experiences when it comes to that.
Yeah, I am very, and I acknowledge that, and it's a privilege, and I don't try to squander that particular privilege.
Right.
But it's amazing that I'm calling a privilege what should be normal.
Exactly. Right.
That's how it should be, you know?
Right.
And so when I think of the down low brothers, down low brothers are usually down low because they know that they are frightened of their masculinity being questioned, or the lack of support they will receive, or they grieve before it's happened their loss of community. And that has to be a scary place to be. And until we fully dissect these things, these are going to be issues that are not going to be solved.
Right.
Until we dissect them fully, until we acknowledge them 100%. And I hope this book helps people get closer to it. I'm hoping that this helps humanize your son, your daughter, or yourself if you're reading it.
Right. June 10th, everybody. June 10th.
June 10th. Special 10th. Day.
Special day in so many different ways. It's exactly. So what closing thoughts do you have for our listener? Last words of wisdom. Anything you want to say before we wrap up?
Shine on. And we got this.
We've got this. Yeah.
This is what I want you to know. We got this. We got this. And trust me, we got it.
Nice. Where can listeners learn, listen, or hear more about you?
Go to www.aaron, A-A-R-O-N, the number 2.me, or you search for Aaron Myers on all of your streaming platforms and Amazon.
Excellent. Everybody, you better search Aaron. He's wonderful. Now, I wrap up the show by, I say this phrase all the time. It says, accept your sparkle, surrender to it, and allow it to be so. And then I say, until then, keep shining, but I yell it. Mm-hmm. Would you mind? All right. Accept your sparkle, surrender to it, and allow it to be so. Until then, keep shining!